bit.
Hello, this is Kara Vandry of the Ashland City Library, and today we are interviewing Rick Beely of rural Comanche County, and this interview is being done by the Ashland City Library through Humanities Kansas in conjunction with the National Endowment for the Arts Big Read Project. And Rick, you served in the Vietnam War, but what branch of service did you serve?
Marine Corps.
What was your rank when you left?
Captain.
Where did you serve?
In Vietnam, Da Nang, and then Chu Lai, and then Quang Tri, and then back to Da Nang in division headquarters, yes.
Okay. Were you drafted or did you enlist?
I enlisted.
When?
65.
Where were you living when you enlisted?
Oh, it was last semester of college in Alva, Oklahoma.
Did you get your degree before you enlisted?
Mm-hmm. I didn't get to go through the ceremony because I was almost through. I graduated in December and I was almost through officers' candidate school when they graduated in Alva. So.
What was your degree in?
Math and industrial education.
Okay. Why did you join?
I really wanted to learn to fly. Wayne Kinsey, that ran the airport at Alva, gave me a job, and I learned to fly there up to through a private license. But I really wanted to learn to fly. And so... And, of course, the Marine recruiter said, sure, you can get jets. Well, he couldn't guarantee me that, but anyway, I got them.
So that's why you picked the Marines, so that you could fly?
Yes. Of course, the Air Force, I had no idea what I was getting into when I joined the Marines. I tell you, that first 10 weeks of officers' candidate school was pure hell. Excuse me. Anyway.
Why?
Why? Oh, mercy. When we first got there, they were yelling at us, and we felt like worms on the floor for several weeks. And the physical regime was really tough for a 120-pound kid that wasn't into sports. And, of course, towards the end of the 10 weeks, it all turned around. And now, once a Marine, always a Marine, but I had no idea what I was signing up for. I really just joined the Marines because the Marine recruiter at Alva, he's spitting polish.
Did he paint a rosy picture of your future?
Yeah, he said, you can get jets, but he couldn't guarantee me that. But since I already had a private and flying was always so natural to me anyway, I excel, so everything except military bearing, I guess. I wasn't very good at the military bearing part. Anyway.
What is military bearing?
Oh, just enjoy being spit and polish and shining your shoes all the time and coming to work perfect, in your uniform, because you'd get scolded if it wasn't perfect. And, I was more of a Gomer Pyle. I had two left feet. that old movie, show on TV with Gomer Pyle.
Yes.
What was that name of that? I don't remember. But
Gomer Pyle.
I
yes.
think maybe it was yeah. named yes. Gomer Pyle. Anyway.
Did you gain weight in boot camp?
Yes, I went in at 120, and 10 weeks later I weighed 134.
And they muscled you up.
Yes.
Okay. You've already described your first days in service as probably a lot of running. Did they get you up at 4:30 to go run 5 miles before breakfast?
I don't remember that, but our barracks is right on the Potomac River at Quantico, Virginia, and we were up at daybreak out in front of the barracks facing the Potomac doing PT, but of course we had forced marches later, but all the way through that 10 weeks it was not only classroom study, but it was physical activities too, of course. So anyway, yes.
What were they trying to teach you in your classroom studies?
Military bearing for one thing, and how to use a rifle, and every Marine's a rifleman, even a pilot. So Marine Corps history, and they really indoctrinated us. Like I said, once a Marine, always a Marine. You know, when you see another Marine, you say "Semper Fi" on the way by, and it's just the way it is if you're a Marine. Mm-hmm. The Air Force has their airmen and their officers. The Army has soldiers and officers. The Navy has enlisted and officers. Marines are just Marines, There's there's not that kind of differentiation between the enlisted and the officers. It's just a unique branch of service. That's what the Marine Corps is.
And you chose because they had a very good recruiter.
Yes, and of course it worked out well because I got jets. And in the Air Force, once you got to a squadron after flight training, you might be if you got jets, fighter type jets, might be in the back seat of an F-4 Phantom with some colonel up front flying. But as soon as I checked into Cherry Point after the training command in September 67, I guess, they said, whatever airplane you want to fly on the base, you got 24 hours to decide. And of course, there was Phantoms, F-4s, there was A-4 Skyhawks, there was the C-130s. I could have even gone a step back, I thought, to helicopters. Of course, I didn't want that. But then there was the A-6 Intruder. And it was not a fighter, it was an attack jet. And I wasn't aggressive enough to be a fighter pilot. So, with the A-6, we just, in the middle of the night, we'd turn our lights off and go into bows. So nobody would see us, and we'd drop our bombs and come home, that sort of thing. Besides other work, of course, but the A-6, fit me real well. So
that's what you chose?
Mm-hmm. I chose the A-6. A lot of times it was a single airplane mission. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, a lot of times we did fly formation, but a lot of times it was single airplane and intruder. We could just sneak in and sneak out. Or if we were dive bombing, it was we weren't exposed to enemy fire very long. So anyway, it was a good choice. We dropped a lot of bombs.
On Laos?
What?
Mostly on Laos? Where did you?
No, mostly in Vietnam, but then we'd go into Laos, even though it wasn't spoken about at the time, but we'd work the Ho Chi Minh Trail at night, level bombing, 3,000 feet, mountains beside us, because the Ho Chi Minh Trail was mostly in the valleys. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it was an all-weather airplane, so on radar you could see the mountains out beside us. So, it was systems bombing at night. The bombardier navigator BM beside me, he was looking in his scope and seeing if he could find moving targets, that sort of thing. So,
is that what you mean by systems? Using radar?
Yeah, radar and of course, automatic bomb release. It was a sophisticated computer in the airplane at the time. So even though it was what analog, didn't have digital back in the day, but they said each airframe had 200 miles of wiring in it. So it was a complicated little airplane.
That would weigh a lot too.
Yeah, it weighed 60,000 pounds.
You're joking.
Huh?
The plane weighed 60,000?
Yeah, with fuel and bombs under it. All of our bombs were external under the wings. We carried 28 500-pound bombs on each flight. Oh, sometimes we dropped rockets, fired rockets and CBUs, cluster bomb units, and other things.
A twin-screw truck weighs right at 30,000 GBW. I'm a little bit shocked, okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
See, it was
not a small plane.
Not a small plane. Excuse me.
No, sir.
It's kind of hard to see that through the Maybe I'll just get it out of there for you. See all the bombs under that thing? .28, 500 pounders. If I'd have dropped bombs, my BN and I, every mission, in 6 months, I'd have dropped 1 million pounds of bombs. But it wasn't always bombs, so...
What else would you drop besides bombs?
We fired 2.75-inch rockets and 5-inch Zuni rockets, and we never dropped napalm, but we also, at night in Laos, sometimes we dropped the CBUs, cluster bomb units. We'd drop them, a whole bunch of hand grenade-type things in clamshells. You know, looked like a bomb, but it had all these, basically 200 or 300 in each, probably more than that. And we'd carry maybe 10, and I remember one night we just turned upside down after we dropped them. We dropped them in a train, and it just looked like we was watching it kind of upside down. And just looked like 10,000 flashbulbs going off down there for about a half a mile, you know. We didn't see any secondary explosion, but at any rate, it was an adventure.
What is the difference between a rocket and a bomb?
Difference? Well, these bombs, you know, they're just gravity bombs. They just dropped off, and they had little propellers on the front, and when they left the airplane, they would. There was a wire going back to the bomb rack. And the wire would come out, and then the little propeller would start turning and set the fuse. And some of them we carried had a 3-foot extension on, a pipe extension, so that bomb would go off 3 feet in the air and just, you know. But if it went off on the surface, or then they had a delay on the fuse, it would put it just underground about 10 feet or so before it went off, and it would make a huge crater. Each bomb would make a 20-foot crater and 15 feet deep or 10 feet deep, so.
The picture that Rick is describing will be included in the interview.
So, and then of course, you know, Vietnam looked like the craters on the moon. Some pictures of that, I'm sure. Mostly it's ground pictures. But, I guess I'm not seeing handy. You probably want to keep going with this thing. So anyway, I don't see it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was me.
Sir, let me record several of your pictures.
Okay.
When we're done with the interview. Okay. May I say that the summer dress uniform is very attractive.
Well, yeah, and here's our dress uniform.
Okay.
We had a 64 GTO convertible. And that's in front of our house out east of Coldwater when we came home on leave.
Okay.
And that's the summer, winter dress, and this is the summer dress.
Okay.
And here's our everyday uniform. In the summer, we didn't have to wear a tie. And, of course, the Marine uniform, they call them Marines leathernecks because, you know, look at that tight collar around your neck, you know.
Yes.
So,
and could
then
you
in the winter, we had to wear a tie. But anyway, that's the way it was.
Nice car, too.
Yeah, yeah, there's another picture of our car. Should have kept that thing.
Good.
First year of GTOs.
Oh, yep. Okay.
We drove it here after we came home for several years.
The roads were not kind.
My sister-in-law and brother-in-law over at Mineola have it. You probably don't know them, but they've lived at Mineola forever. Jack and Susie Hubbard. Mm-hmm. Okay. Margo and Susie both grew up on street west of downtown there. So okay. Anyway, yeah.
Well, sir, going back to boot camp, do you remember any of your instructors?
Yeah. That's another story.
Because they were warm and wonderful people.
Oh, some were. I hope I've got it. Maybe I don't. That's messing around at home here. That's the field south of where I grew up. I had the airplane back and had the gear and the flaps down and making low passes, and Mom was taking pictures. But, Shirley.
Do you remember one of their names?
It was so regimented there in OCS that, I wished I had that picture. I thought I did.
What is
anyway,
OCS?
We took a group picture before we graduated, mm-hmm. and there was about 40 of us in the class. And I knew them well enough, and the barracks was even, you didn't do much time visiting at night in the barracks because they had you scrubbing the floors or doing something. And so I knew the guys in the bunks right around me, but the guys at the other end, I didn't know that well. But I knew them well enough to get their names out. So there was a group picture, including of our staff sergeant, platoon sergeant, Carl Taylor. And he was a big guy. But I was reading the Stars and Stripes newspaper one day in Vietnam, and here's his picture on the front page. He was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor. He stormed a machine gun nest or whatever to save his troops. So anyway, and it looks like when we first visited the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, it looked like that they had a catalog along with the wall, moving wall, or yeah, the wall. And on this catalog was the 58,000 plus names. And so I just took that picture with all the names on the back and studied that catalog for a little while. It looks like 16 out of that 40 died in Vietnam. 16 out of 40. But they were young platoon leaders in Ted of 68, and that was pure hell. So, and then, of course, Sergeant Taylor died, of course, too. So, you know, that's the way it was. Fortunately, I wasn't there during that time. But and then in 69, when we were there, Johnson had called the bombing halt over the north for that whole year. So we didn't have to fly north in North Vietnam, mm-hmm. because most of the POWs in North Vietnam were shot down over North Vietnam. So anyway, yeah, didn't have to deal with that. But so anyway, that was, I wish I had that picture, but I don't. So
if you come up with it later, you know I'm putting this on our website.
Yeah.
So any pictures you want included in your interview,
okay, yeah,
let me know.
I can find it all, but I think it's on the wall out the house.
Okay.
But
okay.
This was in basic training at Meridian, Mississippi.
Which one is you?
Figure it out.
Well,
I'm the one with the big ears.
Oh, please.
And then 40 years ago, I had these ears worked on. I hated those ears. The big nose doesn't bother me, but the ears did.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a group picture after a four-plane flight. And, of course, the instructor was in the fifth airplane. Mm-hmm. So that was the end of that phase of training.
What do you remember most about it?
The training command?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, flying those jets. That was great. Of course, we flew the little T-34, which was a modified Beechcraft Bonanza. Different fuselage, same wings and everything. Mm-hmm. But there's me again. I was student of the month in training command once and student of the week another time, so I got pictures of all that.
So your bearing wasn't that bad.
Well, okay. You know, the flying skills were great, so, yeah.
Okay.
And September of 67, about a year and a half after we started flight training. We were naval aviators by then. We landed on the carrier one day, and well, several times.
But which one? Which carrier?
The Lexington. It's a museum down at Corpus now. I've been on it several times. It's kind of a spiritual experience for me to get back on that thing, because with the little T2, there's the T2. That was what we flew at Meridian, Mississippi. And then we went out to Kingsville and flew the F-9 Cougar. And, of course, they've got an example of most Navy Marine Corps airplanes on that carrier now as a museum. And the F-9 sitting out there on the flight deck. I take my logbook now when I go somewhere. And I'd flown that airframe. That bureau number was in my logbook. Not this one, of course, but the one on the carrier now. So, you know, it was...
So it wasn't destroyed. It was saved.
Yeah, that one was, okay. Just for the museum.
Okay.
And, of course, they were doing some formation flying. Well, actually, this was my first ride in a jet. Four students were finishing up the last flight of their program, so the instructor had me in the back seat, and he was doing loops and all kinds of things out there. And, I got sick. I thought, what am I getting into? This was Ryan. Remember Ryan Dewey?
Yes.
When he was an infant.
I rode the bus with him for a bit, just a little bit,
oh,
yes.
Yeah, he...
Because, you know, they changed routes.
Oh, okay. But... Yeah, he passed away.
Yes.
12 years ago. Okay. And, of course, I guess I didn't need to bring this. I have it here. But my best friend at Cherry Point was a bombardier navigator.
Mm-hmm.
And so we partied. This is Margot, and this is Leslie, his wife. And this was in 68. We were out on the beach having a picnic. Mm-hmm. And there's Ryan, and there's their two kids, mm-hmm. Carrie and Greg. And I keep up with Leslie, but of course Chuck, he was killed in Vietnam, so they went down an airplane in Laos that night. So at any rate, we were just out in Pensacola about a year ago, seeing Leslie and her second husband, who was also a Marine pilot, of course, Carrie's 50-some years old now, so she ain't with us, her and her husband. So, yeah, you know, I'd seen him a few times over the years. So, anyway, you know, he was my best friend. And I just didn't get close to anybody after he passed away. And, you know, it was
kind of
tough. He was my roommate, and that's the reason I went from Da Nang to Chulai. They wanted to kind of break the outfit up, so I volunteered to go down because Chuck was down there, and he didn't last a week after I got there. So, yeah. And then, how much time we got here?
We have an hour and a half, 2 hours.
Oh.
I plugged them in. The batteries will not die.
Okay.
Okay.
And then, of course, the evening he went out, it was a nighttime mission in Laos, and the evening he and Steve, the pilot, went out, I ate with him. We had lobster and steak that night, which was terribly uncommon. But Steve Armstead, a good friend, but not as close as Chuck and I were, he pulled a prayer card out. And so we got quiet to let him read that to himself. And then we ate. Nobody ever did that, but he must have had a premonition he was going to die that night. That's my guess. Anyway, that night, an Air Force C-130 was dropping flares over there in Laos because they had a truck on a bridge that was stopped, and they were wanting to bomb that thing. And so we didn't dive bomb at night. We did it all the time in the daytime, 30-degree dive. 450 knots at 3,000 feet, pull 4 Gs. get rid of the bombs before we started pulling out, of course. But then we could get out of the area before the shrapnel came up and got the airplane. But anyway, okay. We didn't do that at night. But they accepted that mission, and then that C-130 people reported the next day that that they called in hot, which we did, of course. And then we called off cold when we pulled off the target. And, of course, on one run, they called in hot. The bombs went off. And then there was another flash several hundred yards away. And no more was heard from them. We carried four survival radios, two in our vest and two on the seat pin. And, you know, if he's in a chute, you were going to talk on the way down, tell somebody you survived so far. But anyway, nothing. And so the next day or two, I wrote Leslie. And I said, you know, Leslie, they've just sent you a notice saying Chuck is missing in action. Form letter. And I said, if it was me, I said, Margo would want to know, you know, what really happened. And I said, I explained, you know, what happened. They even went in the next day with photo recons, but the wreckage went down in three canopies of jungle over there, so they didn't find anything. And so I wrote her a letter and told her that the chances that Chuck was gone was 99.9%. And so she got on with her life and then married this other Marine lieutenant captain. And he had to spend a year in Vietnam too. So, I left my phone pictures out in the car. But at any rate, I got a picture of that couple and Carrie and Junior, her husband, when we were down there last fall. And I'd stopped to see Leslie two, three times in the past, four maybe, in the last 50 years. So we kept up. Well, anyway, in the year 2000, 31 years later, he died in March of 69. And all during that time, in the back of my mind, I thought, you know, what if Chuck walks out of that jungle somehow after all those years and she's got on with her life? You know, it kind of bothered me in the back of my mind a little bit. But I felt like she deserved to know what we knew, so I'd have probably gotten in trouble at the time for sending that letter. But at any rate, 31 years later, in the year 2000, Leslie called me. And she said, they're burying Chuck's remains at Arlington Friday. I just want you to know up in case you want to get back there. This was in the year 2000. And they'd gone in there and found that wreckage after 31 years and found one tooth of Chuck's. I mean, it just went in like that. It's a wonder they found anything, especially 31 years later. But they found one tooth, and the DNA proved it was Chuck. And, of course, they couldn't find any remains of Steve, the pilot. But a villager brought a dog tag out to you know, he'd scrounged around that wreckage sometime way in the past, and it was Steve's dog tag. So, you know, finalized that story finally, and we've been back to D.C. since, and I've got a picture of his military monument there in the Arlington Cemetery. So, anyway, that's that story. That's that story. And, of course, it tells it here in this article, too. But he came up through the enlisted program. Mm-hmm. And they had a meritorious NCO program, non-commissioned officer. And he excelled as an enlisted man. He was at 8th and I in D.C., which is Marine Corps headquarters. I don't know what it is, but it's nationally known as the Marine Corps base in D.C., 8th and I Street. And, of course, he was on that precision drill team, that silent team that, you know, twirled the rifles and with the bayonets on the end. You've seen some of that.
Yes.
He was on that team. And then, when Kennedy died, in November of 63, he was in the honor guard that took his body to the cemetery. So, and then Chuck got into the officer program. And I've always said, you know, he was spit and polish, you know. You can see by his picture that he was spit and polish fellow. He was an ideal Marine, and I don't know why we hit it off, except he was from a small town in Mississippi and farmer type, and I was a farmer's kid. So we flew together quite a bit. You could, sometimes, especially checking an airplane out on the weekend from Cherry Point, they just say, keep it in the continental United States. So we were all over the United States at low level, and on nice weekends, I liked to fly when the weather was good. So anyway, I've always said he'd been a general if he'd lived, but at any rate, one weekend we landed down at Columbus Air Force Base, and his folks picked us up. We spent the weekend at his place, and one weekend we came into McConnell and spent the weekend out here with the folks, and folks picked us up at McConnell. So anyway, memories.
Yep. Sorry.
Do what?
I'm sorry.
Oh, well, you know, that's ancient history. That was 53 years ago. One funny little story. Every time I go to Wichita on 160, you turn north 3 miles to go into Harper. Mm-hmm. Well, on the west side, about halfway up there, it used to be a red brick house. They've recovered the siding now. And it was just basically a house at the time. Now there's a little auto body repair shop. You know where I'm talking. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, we were heading to Wichita that day, and we were a little bit ahead of schedule, so I knew the folks wouldn't quite be there. So I said, Chuck, let's just go out there on 160 and see if we can find them. Dad drove a white four-door 64 Chevy at the time. And approaching that stop sign from the west, there they were. So we circled until they decided, yeah, that's Rick and Chuck, and so they stopped right behind that yellow brick house, and we were buzzing them and doing aileron rolls and having a good time right a mile or two south of Harper. I'll bet even in Harper they was wondering what the devil was going on out there. But every time I go to Wichita, I think of that, and that was in the fall of 68. So that's been
54 years ago.
Yeah, maybe 67. No, it was 68, the fall of 68. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 54 years ago. But I think about it every time I go to Wichita. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so anyway.
Okay.
Well, we had a lot of fun.
And they let you just take planes out and have a good time on the weekend.
Yeah, I've got some pictures.
Did it keep you sharp, or just why would they do that with what it costs to fly a plane? Did it keep you sharp?
Well, back in those days, we could land anywhere on a military base and pump kerosene, basically kerosene, you know, jet fuel. I think it only cost 10 cents a gallon, so back then. But, yeah, just keep it in the continental United States. So, and it wasn't just Chuck, so about once a month, about 15 months at Cherry Point, I'd grab somebody that wanted to go out west. One friend, I can't think of his last name now, Roy, his folks were in Minneapolis, and so we that was probably the day I was buzzing the house out here. But anyway, we ended up in Minneapolis, and after we'd been down in this country, and that's the closest I ever came to a flight violation. We were 500 feet, 350 knots, which we did all the time across the United States. And, you know, you didn't go back and buzz somebody because they were probably pretty unhappy you were there to start with at that altitude, especially if they had livestock out in pasture. But anyway, or turkeys hated airplanes. But at any rate, that's what we did, and spent the weekend with his folks. And even back in the training command, it was just about finished at Kingsville and the F-9s. But there was a hurricane coming in, I forget the name of it, but it took out so many windows in Corpus Christi. And so another student and I, two airplanes, and the instructor in a third airplane, got out of there. And of course, Margot and Ryan, they had to stay, but then they were in a good, secure place. But anyway, we went to Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And yet I didn't finish my Sioux City story, I'm sorry. We were low level, heading to Minneapolis, and at 500 feet. And the Sioux City Airport is down on the opposite side of the Missouri River. And of course, on the other bank of the Missouri is a pretty high cliff. And I did not see that airport. We were so low until I was right in our traffic pattern. And I flew right across the airport, controlled airport, without talking.
Yes.
However, I had just made a VFR position report. We had to talk tell them every hour about where we were at. Mm-hmm. And I made it to Sioux City Radio. So the tower came back a minute later and said, "Marine Umpty Ump, was that you just flew over?" I figured for sure I'd have a flight violation when I got to Minneapolis, but they let it go. So, and then another time, earlier, like I was starting another story, we flew into Sioux Falls, South Dakota for the weekend. And it was completely civilian airport. We walk out to the old F-9, you know, with our whole flight gear on, and the crowd in the terminal waiting on a flight or something would look at us on the way by, you know, and then we'd crank those jets and go fly. But we stayed with the instructor's family. And I cannot think of his name right now. Hopefully I'll think of it in a little while. And then he was killed later in Vietnam. But Tom Brokaw did a documentary on Vietnam, I guess. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it sure included Vietnam. Mm-hmm. But him and, can't think of his name, him and our instructor had been best friends in college at the University of South Dakota or wherever, because Brokaw was from South Dakota. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he showed a picture of his gravesite there in Sioux Falls. And I remember his folks lived near downtown Sioux Falls, and he was an auto. His dad was an auto mechanic. Just real down-to-earth, friendly people. But can't remember his name yet. But anyway,
was that common that you would just get to know people well and?
You what?
Was that common that you would just get to know people, and then they passed away?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, at Meridian. Basic training, flying that little T-2, John McCain was an instructor in the same squadron. I looked at my logbook later. I never flew with him. But, and us kids just kind of stayed out of his way because, you know, we were 22 and he was already 30, I think, 8 years older. And his dad was the top admiral in the Pacific when he was a POW, and his granddad was top admiral in World War I days. As a matter of fact, he was one of the, John McCain, the senior, was one of the first naval aviators. Mm-hmm. And the airport there at Meridian, mm-hmm. the Marine Corps base, Naval Air Station, was named McCain Field after his granddad, I guess.
Yes.
And John McCain was a real hot shot then. He barely made it through the academy with all the stunts he pulled, and I read his autobiography, and he said one day he was coming in to land at Meridian Air Station, and the tower told him to go around. He said, "I don't have to. This is my airport." You know, that's the kind of attitude he had, but, you know, after his 5 years plus in Hanoi Hilton, you know, he was a great guy after that, but I never walked up and met him because he wasn't interested in meeting some second lieutenant going through the flight training program. So, anyway, unless he flew with him. Anyway, that's that story, so yeah.
I read his book too. It was well written.
Yeah. But that's, you remember, he said that in that book.
Yes.
I don't have to. It's my report.
Well, but, he went on to even greater things.
Yeah. Oh, this was some of our flying out west, you know, back with the A6. I can't read my writing upside down, but
ECM.
Yeah, this is the Lake Mead and the.
Is it Hoover?
And the Boulder Dam. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, it's upside down, but anyway, that's that big crater out there.
Yes.
We just had so much fun. And I don't know. Anyway, bugs on the windshield. That's how low we were. Notice the bugs.
How low do you have to fly to get bugs?
Oh, we were at 500 feet, so there's a lot of bugs to get up past that, of course, with updrafts. And on a hot day in the desert, you're going to have updrafts. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and we were several times, we flew down through the bottom. The Grand Canyon's 5,000 foot deep, and then the last 1,000 feet down to the Colorado River is a real tight little canyon. We weren't down in there, but we were 3,500 feet below the rim, just flying back and forth sometimes and follow the leader type stuff, and sometimes by ourselves, and it was fun. We had a lot of fun flying that airplane, and this was my colonel. He was almost like a father figure to me, and he gave me a huge compliment years later, because I kept up with him till he, as a matter of fact, him and Steve.
That was Skipper Ron T.
Do what?
Skipper Ron
Townsend.
T.
Yeah.
Townsend.
But, I got a picture somewhere of water skiing. But anyway, Sandy Larson and the skipper came out from California on Southwest about 15 years ago, and I picked him up in Oak City. And we spent 3 or 4 days messing around here, and then we went back to Albuquerque because my sister Peggy lives there, so we spent the night there, and they went home. So, but he gave me a supreme compliment years later. He said, "Rick, you're one of five pilots that I've ever met." And he knew a lot of pilots, of course. He was our skipper, and he'd flown for 20 years in the service before that. And he said, "You're one of five pilots I've ever met that has that kind of natural flying ability." So, boy, that that was a huge compliment. But here's our trip over. We flew these A6s to Vietnam, and there was... we didn't have enough fuel to make Hawaii from the west coast, so the tankers, C-130s, met us out there, excuse me, halfway to take on gas. And here we're plugged, yeah, that's a good idea. And here we're plugged in getting fuel to get to Hawaii. And the best drink I ever had, I think, Marine gals, wax, I can't remember what to... Women Marines, anyway. They brought a Mai Tai out to us just as soon as we landed there at Kinahoi Bay in Hawaii, made out of a fresh pineapple, and oh, that was a delicious drink. So that was fun. And then, of course, we landed at Wake for the night, Wake Island.
Where is Wake Island?
It's far enough west of Hawaii that we had to take on gas again. Mm-hmm. Probably 2,000 miles west of Hawaii. There was one little island called Johnston Island below us when we were taking on fuel, but they didn't want us to land down there. It was just a little rectangle they pulled up enough to make an airstrip there at Johnston Island, but it was a nuclear storage facility at the time. And so we met the 130s again and took on gas. And then the next stop was, after Wake, was Guam. And the next day was the Philippines. And the next day was Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And, here's Wake and some of the...
World War II Memorial?
Yeah, that's a memorial, and that's an old Japanese anti-ship gun still rusting down out there. Then in Vietnam one day... the bomb dump blew up, and even though it was a mile away from us, it was about 30 times during the day, there was a huge explosion.
Where was this?
Da Nang.
This is Da Nang, and the bomb drop blew up at Da Nang.
Yeah, the bomb dump, yeah.
Why did it blow up?
I think they were just mowing. At first they thought there was a suspected VC in his Jeep going to the brig, but then I think they just decided it was a local Vietnamese burning the edge of the bomb dump, and he got too deep. But look what it did to our huts. When we were flying, we lived in these nice Dallas huts. In
it's around
four partitions.
There
was two of us. Eight guys lived in there. Mm-hmm. But look what that concussion a mile away did to the wall of those things. It was.
You weren't home at the time?
Yeah, we were right there.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, time to party near the bunker. Because a lot of times 2.75-inch rockets, like this thing going up, would come back down. And I don't know if I'll have a picture of that. But that was a, that blast would stay red until it got up to a couple hundred feet. And then it'd start dying out, and it left an over, smoke ring at 1,000 feet for quite a while. The airport was 3 miles away, but they shut it down that day because of those terrific bomb blasts, just tearing so much stuff up. And of course, it went on after dark, and there were some after dark pictures. And anyway.
Wow.
Anyway, quite an experience. And here's our A6 loaded again. Mm-hmm. So,
why do you call those Easter eggs the bombs?
Because at Easter, the ordnance people painted it up like Easter eggs. Happy Easter, Charlie, all that kind of stuff.
Okay. I didn't realize it was so mountainous.
Yeah, Vietnam's full of mountains, yeah. Yeah. This F4 and the next outfit over behind revetments. We parked airplanes behind revetments, and they were 5 feet thick with sand. But a rocket went off on one of those F4s, and that's what it did to that revetment that it was aimed at. It was a pretty loud bang. Nobody was hurt. And then this F4, he got too low, and see the damage to the airplane from the trees.
But he survived it?
Yeah, he brought the airplane back.
Okay. The last person I interviewed did airframe repair.
Yeah, so he would have been working on something like
that. Yeah.
But we lived in these Dallas huts and had these 55-gallon drums of sand around the thing, so if the rockets came in, we just continued to sleep because that would be a direct hit to get you. And here's one night when a friend was going out. I just took the camera out and put it on a tripod and that's the plane captain. It was timed so long that it just looked like, lights all around. But one picture. I guess I didn't enclose it. It was, he was spreading the wings because we always folded the wings. It was a Navy airplane, too, and they had to have folded wings to get them in the hangar deck of the carrier. So I never flew this off a carrier. But anyway, you could see the wings spreading with the navigation lights. But anyway, I don't have that picture. But anyway... Yeah, that was the aftermath of one of our drops. And there you can see all the craters in Vietnam. Here too, probably. Another picture after our drop. Put up huge dust clouds. Anyway, yep.
What, A7 wreckage near your hangar?
Yeah. a Navy A7, carrier based, got shot up one day. And this was a two-light. And, you know, he decided, probably losing hydraulic fluid, whatever, decided he probably couldn't make it out the carrier, so he was coming to July. And in the downwind, he lost control of the airplane. Hydraulic fluid all left or whatever. And his wingman was behind him trying to shoot it down. And AmeriCal division was just about a half a mile south of where we were. And the rounds were coming down in an AmeriCal division, and he still didn't get it shot down. It went on around and landed right on the outside of the bomb dump, and right behind our hangar. And they had just rebuilt our hangar from another explosion a few months earlier. It was a real fiasco. And of course, one night, rockets came in and got an A4 outfit right next to us, and so there was quite a bit of damage there. Well, those things had roofs on them before that rocket came in, so it did a lot of damage. And here we are having a good time.
Perfectly sober.
Yeah, well, pretty much. Yeah, we never got real drunk except one major. He'd shut the bar down at night, the old club, and then they'd go out to fly, and, you know, he took his BN with him. They didn't come back just because he was drunk, I think. But, I don't know. Here was a nice old club at July. It was bamboo, right on the beach, and, grass-thatched roof. I don't remember that, but the Army Major was in trouble with the liquor on it. And right at that same time, this club burned to the ground. I always will believe that the Sergeant Major that ran that club, or the Sergeant, was also involved in a liquor scam, whatever.
Yes.
And didn't want the audit to happen, so it burned down. I think that's what happened, but I don't know that. And then every once in a while, we'd have a floor show, some Filipino bunch, or maybe even local Vietnamese, and, you know, singing the songs we love to hear, like The Animals. I got to get out of this place if it's the last thing I ever do. And we'd sing along with them, of course, so it wasn't all. And then, of course, this July outfit was going to, you know, Nixon was starting to wind things down, and this outfit was heading to Japan. Well, I was a new guy in it, so I got assigned to Quang Tree flying the bird dog. I flew it for a couple of months. And, of course, I was a tail dragger pilot before I went in the military, so that was fun flying, too. I never got any holes in the wings or anything, so.
And it was reusable.
Okay. Yeah, barely. It was a pretty junky airplane by that time. But here we're just flying around looking at the craters, and we had a few 2.75-inch rockets on the under the wing of that thing, so you can kind of see them there. But there was a boat out in the, what they call those, I can't think what they're called. This is a hospital ship. You can see a chopper coming in, bringing a casualty. It was right off the coast of Da Nang there, July. And we were in a campground in La Vida, Colorado. Doesn't matter where, but last summer with family. And there was another Kansas plate there, so I went over and visited with them, this John, I can't think of his last name now, but he was a medic on that ship when I was taking that picture. So, you know, it's kind of a small world.
Well,
there's North Vietnam across the
river.
What river was that called? I can't even remember now.
I thought you weren't allowed to go into the demilitarized zone, and that was to the north. But you could fly over it?
Well, on the south half we did, yeah. On the south half of the river, but we didn't cross the river. Then we were in North Vietnam.
Right.
But that was just some of our flying with the bird dog. Mm-hmm. And somewhere here there's a picture of a... Well, one day I went out with the doctor and to a refugee village. Several of us just out of boredom went out to this refugee village. And this old church had been a training facility for the Viet Cong.
Yes.
See their guns up on the, yes, painted on the wall. This guy, and I didn't know him well, just basically that day, because he didn't fly the bird dog, he flew the old V-10. And he was passing candy out to the little kids, and I don't think I got a picture. Maybe I do, I don't know. Anyway, he was flying the OV-10, it's a twin-engine airplane, and they were just taking off from Quang Tri. It was also in our squadron, but I guess he lost an engine on takeoff, and he must not have been very familiar with the airplane, because he feathered the wrong engine, and they went into the top of the hangar, and him and his backseater both bled to death out from the crash of the tin of the hangar and all that. Within a few minutes, they bled to death. But anyway, a lot of stories. And here some of us are trying to pump water. Those Vietnamese would had a basket, and there was two people on ropes at each side of that basket, and they were just making that basket probably held 10 gallons. Mm-hmm. They were just making, pulling water out of that just like that, and flooding their rice paddies, you know, almost as fast as a fairly good pump would pull it up.
Okay.
Yeah.
Although probably more labor intensive.
Yeah. And of course, we was on Okinawa taking some little flat forward air controller training, and this was along the beach, and you know, World War II was, and Okinawa was ferocious. It was horrible, you know. Women and kids jumping off the cliffs and they hiding in caves, all kinds of stuff. But anyway, and then, I don't remember. Oh, it was October of 69. Oh, I had about 3 months left. Margo and I met in Hawaii for a week, so that was fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, my experience with war wasn't all that bad.
Well, let's go back. When you were done with boot camp, where did you go next?
Oh, to Pensacola for pre-flight training.
What is that?
Shorts and probably barefoot, we had to run in sand traps for maybe 2 miles, you know. Running in sand's not easy. And, you know, one thing we had to do, besides the indoor training, I don't remember so much of that at Pensacola, but they had an Olympic-sized swimming pool. Of course, it was so deep you couldn't touch the bottom. And we had to pass a swimming test. Had to swim a mile in that pool, and you had to turn around and go back the other way without touching the ends. I never was a swimmer, and I just did the backstroke. It took me an hour and a half, but I got through it. So, you know, it was that sort of thing. But I don't remember too much classroom study there. And then we were still at Pensacola. That was just a few weeks. And then VT-1 was out at Softly Field out northwest of Pensacola in the little T-34s I was talking about. And so, you know, that's where I got the student of the week and student of the month. And of course, that's where it was decided which students would get jets and which one would get choppers. And there was only one jet slot open that week, and there was 10 Marines graduating. I got the jet slot. Otherwise, I'd have been in a chopper in Vietnam, and that wouldn't have been fun. So, anyway.
Well, what was your assignment then when you got when you graduated from Pensacola? What was your assignment? What were you called?
Well, we were still in the early part of flight training, because from Pensacola, we went up to Meridian, Mississippi, and flew the jets for the first time. That was called basic. And then after that, 6 months, we went back to Pensacola and did our carrier qualifications, and also air-to-air gunnery, although the A-6 never had guns on it, but we still practiced that. Out over the Gulf, another T-4 would be pulling a banner maybe 1,000 feet behind it, I don't know, back a ways. And we'd be on what we called the perch, 2,000 feet up and to the side, and we'd come in and dive and shoot into that banner. And each airplane had different colored chalks on the ground, so they could tell who hit and who didn't. It was hard to hit. And then, of course, that carrier call business. What you saw earlier was we went out a week before on the Lexington from Pensacola to watch the class ahead of us land. And so that's what you were seeing on those early pictures of the landings. And a week later, we were doing the same thing.
How long does it take from when you first get to basic training until you are a fully fledged fighter? How long does that take for training?
A year and a half. Mm-hmm. So from Pensacola and the carrier quals, we went out to Kingsville, Texas, flying the old F-9. It was Korean War vintage. It was getting old by that time. It had a strange British-designed engine in it. It wasn't an axial flow like all the jets have now. The air comes in, and then it's compressed by turbines, and then there's the firing section. And then it leaves that under tremendous heat and speed. And then the turbines behind that run the front turbines. And this thing was completely different. It was Biddle in World War II developed the first jet. Of course, Germany was developed at the same time. But this engine, I think, what they call that? A radial flow, maybe, because the burners, where you actually had the ignition, was around the outside of the engine, almost like a radial airplane engine. And they were so underpowered. And on a 100-degree day at Kingsville, we'd roll most of the runway for those things to get airborne. So, and then we also made carrier quals there, too, with the F-9. So, yep, that's
your,
the way it was.
Your tour of duty could not have been just 2 years, then, if they spend a year and a half training you.
3 years. We were committed to 3 years, yeah.
Okay.
And so, you know, I was 2.5 years out when I got back from Vietnam. So I had another 6 months at Cherry Point. But then I knew I wanted to get out. I thought maybe I wanted to be an airline pilot at the time. But there was a recession about 1970, so they weren't hiring right then. And so I just bought a spray plane, and the rest is history. I got to sleep in my own bed every night and still have a flying career, so it was pretty neat.
I remember that you had a little helicopter for a while.
No, I never did care for helicopters. Now, the flight instructor would have one. What was his? Ellis. Robert Ellis,
mm-hmm.
His family owned the Havilland Telephone Company at the time, so, you know, he had some money, and he had a little helicopter, and
maybe that's
he wanted me to ride with him one day, but I said, no offense, Robert, but that's not my cup of tea. Propeller's supposed to be on the front, not on top. So many moving parts on a helicopter, too, and every one of them, I think, is critical to survival. That one big nut on the center of the blades up there, they call it the Jesus nut. That's how important it is. Helicopters never was my thing.
Okay. You did not You were not involved in combat. You were the one dropping the bombs. How did they assign where you were supposed to drop bombs? Who decided that?
I don't know. That came down from headquarters, and it even came from Washington, you know. Even when they were flying so hard over North Vietnam, they had to hit specific targets. I think they had a surface-to-air missile factory, maybe in Hanoi. I don't remember for sure, but, you know, they wouldn't let you bomb something important like that. So, but fortunately, I missed all that part. But I flew the A-6 120 missions over there, and then I flew that Bird Dog for 2 months also. I think it was only 20 missions, but then I had a desk job the last 4 months, which made me happy.
Were you awarded any medals or Were you awarded any medals or citations?
Nah, just the normal ones. I don't know what took to earn those, what they call them, flight medals? I can't remember what they call it. But with 120 missions, somehow I got one medal with number five on it. You know, it was kind of an award, I guess, but no, I never got a Bronze Star. My granddaughter, Rebecca, remember her? She joined the Army National Guard out of Hayes in a transportation outfit out of high school probably 15 years ago when she graduated. And she spent 2 tours in Iraq, 2 years and 3 months total. And she came home with a Bronze Star. I said, "What'd you do to earn that, Beck?" And she said, "Well, nothing in particular. I think it was a Bronze Star for meritorious service. And of course, they had another Bronze Star for valor, but I don't think she earned that one." But I said, "What'd you do to earn that?" She said, "Well, as a truck driver," she said, "I just went out every time they asked me to, and outside the wire," she called it, and even volunteered when so many of them would do anything they could to get out of it.
Yeah.
And she's never talked much about it. So I think she's got some PTSD. She's happily married up in Michigan. And so she and her husband will be down here. He came from Wichita, so they'll be down here in a couple of weeks, so I'll get to see him. So anyway, she came home with a Bronze Star. And she never got hurt, but she told me just enough to know that some of her convoy got blown up, and this one gal was just hysterical, and Beck had to slap her to get her back to reality, that sort of thing. So, you know, she saw a lot that I didn't see.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever fired on?
Oh, yeah, no doubt. But we were never hit. I remember one night over in Laos, of course, black night and all. Kind of looked back behind us, and the 37mm was coming up, the AAA. And every fifth round was a tracer, so there was quite a few rounds, but they were behind us. We were in there with our lights off, and preferably on a cloud deck in the middle of the night, so, you know, they were just shooting at sound. Here again, they left their radar guns up north, knowing we'd come back, and we did in 70 and 71, so they were just using gun sight and sound, I guess, to shoot at us. So. And I'm sure on our close air support, supporting the troops there in Vietnam, I'm sure that small arms were coming up at us, but we were in and out of there so quick that maybe on this wall of that church I showed you, they had an AK-47 drawn there and a yardstick secured to the barrel, the end of the barrel. And on that yardstick, they had a helicopter and a fixed wing and a jet. And of course, the VC, that's how they aimed it at whatever was coming at them. They, you know, had to aim way ahead. They put the jet behind this jet, and they had to aim way ahead. You know, that's how crude it was.
And that's how slow the ammunition was.
Well, it wasn't so much that, but it was just the different speeds of the different machines they were shooting at. So. But unlike Gene Allen, he was in the thick of it. I hope he'll open up to you and don't bring it up unless he does. But he told me a couple of stories one time. One day he was walking point, and of course he was a Marine, and a grunt Marine, and he said, I was walking point, and he said, saw a flash out there, and instantly he said, he was thrown back about 20 feet. That round hit him in the flak jacket, but it protected him, but he was thrown back about 20 feet. He said another time, he was just getting a ride on top of an armored personnel carrier, and they went under a tree, and a sapper charge went off. And he said there were six or eight of us up there, and he said there was a machine gun. And he said I was the only one that wasn't hurt. And he said a pregnant mama saw him, jumped up out of the road ditch. I just grabbed that weapon and mowed her ass down, that's what he said. And he got in trouble for a little bit until they traced the charge back to her. So, you know, that's just two stories he told me. And it went on all year for him, I'm sure. So, you know, I think I remember it right, but maybe you shouldn't bring it up unless he does and listen to his version instead of mine. But at any rate, he was in the worst of it. And the reason he got there, he told me in high school, he said, I had a whole stack of tickets. He said, drove like hell. He said, I was getting a ticket every time. And that's what he showed me, but it was probably not a big stack like he talked. But he said Spec Zilke was the probate judge. And city judge, I'm sorry. And Spec was a Marine in Korea. But of course, he didn't have to go overseas. But he was a Marine during Korea. And he said, Gene, I'm going to have to send you to jail unless you join the Marine Corps. Looking back on it, Gene probably thought he might have been better off in jail. Anyway, he survived it okay, but I'm sure he's had a lot of PTSD, because boy, after he came home, he'd fired at any provocation, so. Mm-hmm.
What was your life like on the ground? Besides getting, it sounds like you got to go on different trips. Sounds like because you were
in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we were always on a secure base in Vietnam, but the rockets had come in some, and it wasn't completely secure. Matter of fact, one night, Al Jerry, another dear friend, but not as dear as Chuck. But anyway, Al. And I flew together in the middle of the night. This was 1069 just starting. And, you know, 1068 was horrible. And, of course, that night we were taxiing 2 miles to the other end of the runway because the wind was out of the north. We had to get clear down there to take off. And about midnight, probably. And a few rockets came in, and so we just accelerated our checklist and got out there. And a couple hours later, we left enough fuel to go to Thailand, you know, if there was something big going on. But there was a bomb dump blowing up there at Da Nang, so nothing else, quiet. So we, of course, debriefed and stuck around the squadron until daylight, thinking, you know, if they needed another flight, if this was another TAT 68 type thing, we'd be glad to take it so somebody else didn't have to get up. But there wasn't. So that was 3 hours or so. So then we got on the 6-by. Our living quarters were a couple of miles away. And we were through flying for the day. But about the time we got up there, another bunch of rockets came in and blew up the bomb dump that was right beside us on the way up, and also, not the bomb dump, but the fuel depot. And and then, of course, right where we got on that 6-by in front of the hangar, a rocket round came down and put a crater in the concrete, or asphalt, whatever it was, about 3 feet around, 4 feet around, and a couple of feet deep, right where we got on that six line. And a little shrapnel came through the ready room too, but nobody was hurt. Anyway, so we got off the truck and we're drinking a little beer because we didn't have anything to do for the rest of the day except sleep and unwind a little. So we were behind this bunker that maybe not as tall as a ceiling, but certainly 8 or 9 feet tall. We were right behind that bunker, and there was a firefight going over out there, I don't know, maybe a mile away. It sounded like a bunch of firecrackers going off in unison, you know. But we were secure right behind that bunker. But Al, he was standing right beside me, and two other guys were there with us, too. I don't remember them, but who they were but at the time, now. But Al was standing right beside me. And he went down on his hands and knees, and I just thought he already had a little too much to drink. And finally, he said, I've been hit. A round came down over the top of that bunker, and we were right close to it. It had to come down, not vertically, but almost. It got him right in the throat. And, of course, we grabbed a hold of him, and he could still kind of walk, so we got him down the sick bay right quick. And it's just thick, dark blood. It wasn't just spurting out of his neck. And I was writing the flight schedule at the time, so I didn't get out on the hospital ship there in Da Nang Harbor to see him, but some of the guys did. And he was sitting up in bed writing notes because he couldn't talk. But a day or two later, he died. That round must have been infected or something. I don't remember now any more details. But it could have just as well been me. But, you know, compared to the grunts out in the field like Gene, nothing compared.
We're going to take a short break.
Okay.